So the first thing to say is, I'm sorry I have to speak in English. My French isn't good enough. It would be painful. But I am extremely happy to be here. I've had the most wonderful time. I've had the most wonderful time. Thank you very much. And I think you should have said just a few years ago, because if you say I was taught by him hundreds of years ago, what do they think of me? And if I were to tell you that I taught this wonderful student from France 11 or 12 years into my career when I had already left Cambridge, my only solution is to tell you I began speaking as a teaching as a child, because otherwise it's too embarrassing. I've been at it too long. So what I'm speaking about is I'm going to give you a snapshot, a little window into recent developments in United Kingdom public law. I'm afraid there will be no theory. I don't really understand theory. We can have a knockout question from the director later. It'll be a set of stories about where Britain is constitutionally. And it starts with the United Kingdom Supreme Court, and then it talks about Brexit, and then it talks about the rule of law. So those are my three themes. They all interlink. First of all, it is a big deal for the United Kingdom to have a Supreme Court. It's quite new. You might say, oh my goodness, how? It's supposedly a well-established Western democratic country. Well, it has only had a Supreme Court since 2009. So that in itself is odd. And then what was so important about 2009? The reason the United Kingdom has a Supreme Court is because the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Tony Blair, was fed up with his Lord Chancellor, who was called Derry Irving, but did not have the courage to sack him. Derry Irving was this towering, brilliant lawyer who was at the center of government. And he had been the shadow Lord Chancellor, which means the top law person in politics in opposition. And then when Mr. Blair won an election in 1997, he became the Lord Chancellor. And he was the Lord Chancellor for 6 years. He had been Tony Blair's pupil master. Tony wanted to become a barrister, and he met his wife, Cherie, at the chambers run by Derry Irving. Irving called himself Cupid QC, Cupid QC, bringing together the future prime minister and his wife. And he was a very powerful personality. And the Blair team eventually got annoyed with him, fed up with him. And they didn't, as I say, have the courage to just say, get out. In 2003, one morning, they abolished the office of Lord Chancellor. They abolished it. That afternoon, they reinstated it because they did not realize the enormous number of legal complications involved in abolishing the office of Lord Chancellor. It was ancient, and that's going to be one of my key points, ancient, as is the whole of the British Constitution, going back to medieval times. And so they just replaced him, they sacked him. But they put in place another person as Lord Chancellor, who was a lawyer, called Lord Faulkner. And that then became something you will recognize in France, a kind of Minister of Justice. A Minister of Justice. And since 2010, which is when the Conservative Party took over, first with the Liberal Democrats, and then as a single governing party. As you know, we have no cohabitation in the United Kingdom approach. It's winner takes all. There have been as many as 8 Lord Chancellors. And they have been Lord Chancellors in name only. One of them was called Liz Truss. She's now a slightly absurd figure, posturing around the world in tanks as Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs in Britain. But then she was a Lord Chancellor. And when the judges were under attack for a case they they released on Brexit, she didn't defend them. She didn't defend them. The Lord Chief Justice had to defend them, Lord Thomas. What's my point? The Lord Chancellor was a uniquely powerful figure in the British Constitution. They were in the cabinet, top legal advisor to the government. They were also the head of the judiciary, and they were also the leader of the House of Lords. So in Britain's quaint, unwritten constitutional framework, everything centered on the Lord Chancellor. So Mr. Blair, in getting rid of Lord Irving and in reducing the status of the office and in politicizing it, has done the right thing by separation of powers, but law has lost an awful lot of influence within government. So legal aid is more easily attacked. The judges can be more easily attacked. This powerful figure, who dates right back to the 13th century as an office, no longer stands in their way. So you might be saying, what's this got to do with the Supreme Court? Well, the Constitutional Reform Act of 2005, it formalized the changes that Mr. Blair had initiated when he sacked Derry Irving, but that wasn't much to put in a bill. So they decided to create a Supreme Court. The Constitutional Reform Act of 2005, Part 3, sets up the United Kingdom Supreme Court, UKSC, first time ever. What had it been? Another tiny, tiny dive into history, because the British Constitution is all history. And that's why it's been so easy to exploit, by the way, for Mr. Johnson. We'll get to that. King William, I told you about him the other day. We had a big argument in my class of whether he was from France. I wasn't sure of my geography. Normandy, we'll say, in the 11th century was France. They set up in England. They took it over. And the king was judge and leader. And gradually, the judges became the responsibility of his advisors. And gradually, the judging was done by the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And gradually, the House of Lords, a legislative body, an elite aristocratic body, gradually became the final judicial entity within England. I'm concentrating on England because Scotland's got a different system. And Wales, poor little thing, really is embraced within England. And gradually, this is how the British Constitution works, none of your revolutionary stuff. Gradually, only specialist members of the House of Lords were hearing the cases. That came about, I'm proud to say. This is, by the way, St. Patrick's Day. Did you know that? Did you know that? It's a celebratory day for the Irish. I mention that because although I have an impeccable English accent, I am in fact from Ireland. That is a joke about an impeccable Irish-British accent. In 1843, there was a famous Irish revolutionary leader, not revolutionary, a kind of Martin Luther King man, Daniel O'Connell. And there was a case against him in the House of Lords. And the judges were all going to be the Lords. But they were so, it was so absurd that a motion was tabled that only legally qualified people should hear the case. And so all the rest of them withdrew, and the convictions were quashed. He won in 1843. So that was the precedent. England, until Johnson, the current man, rules on the basis of convention, rules on the basis of practice. The Constitution hinges on that. So in 1876, an Act of Parliament recognized something called the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords, the Appellate Committee. And that set up the Law Lords as the final judicial body. It was remarkable. Not only did you have a Lord Chancellor who was in the cabinet, in the House of Lords, and the leading judge, you had the leading court in Parliament. Let me tell you by way of anecdote how it worked. I was in some, you mentioned I'm a barrister. I was in some cases in the old House of Lords. So this is how you got to the final court. You went into the House of Lords, a regular House of Lords. You went up the stairs and there were these committees investigating this trouble. This is the trouble you're causing. I hope you're still there paying attention. I often wonder, would the machine now say, don't bother to record, or we can skip this bit. I was only joking, okay? Sorry. Pause the tape if you want to go make a cup of tea. And in the panel, we were arguing in front of five judges. One of them was the Lord Chancellor who drafted the Act of Parliament we were actually critiquing. Lord Mackay of Clashfern. The person leading me was married to the Prime Minister. So you had this sense of a very sort of small community running the show. And I remember her name was Cherie Blair. She said at one point, presenting her arguments, our arguments, she said, I can assure the Lord, your lordships, that the Prime Minister is very concerned with filling this gap in the law. I mean, that was outrageous. In other words, poor Mr. Blair was getting up in the morning. He was arranging a war, or he was sacking somebody, or he was engaged in this or that. And his wife was saying, what about the Children's Act 1989? Why don't you improve it? And there was a very cozy atmosphere to that, very informal. That is what was changed by the Constitutional Reform Act 2005, with the elevation of the Lords to a Supreme Court. Now, better separation of powers, just like diminishing the Lord Chancellor was better separation of powers. And then you wonder how effective it is. That's for discussion, really. You're not a court of any worth until you have a building. So they did what you'd expect. They got a great building just across the road from Westminster Abbey, close to Parliament, the Middlesex, Guildhall, and it's beautiful. And if any of you are visiting London, put it on your to-do list. It's a very interesting building, and they have a lovely website, and they're all the judges, they're all the same guy, you know, a white guy from Oxford or Cambridge, but they pretend they're not. So it's full of outreach and warmth and a shop, and you can get little mugs, you know, worth a visit. The United States Supreme Court used to have a shabby little corner and did nothing. The United States Supreme Court got its big building in the 1930s and didn't look back, became much more activist. So there's a connection between architecture and confidence. And so the court started with all of the old law lords. So all the people, they were all men except for declaring interest, a fantastic person whom I greatly admire, Lady Hale. They were taken out of the House of Lords and they were put in the Supreme Court. They were allowed stay as lords. This is material. So they remained in the House of Lords. So they are members of the legislature. But by convention, they never debate. They never speak. And the first appointment, who is a new person, was not a member of the House of Lords at all. So his name was Dyson, very nice guy. And he was unfortunately just Dyson T or something, you know, or Dyson J. And so they changed that. Here's a little bit of Englishness for you. The Queen allows them to carry the courtesy title of Lord or Lady. In other words, they can pretend to be a Lord or a Lady. If they are trying to get a restaurant, they can say on the phone, Lord this or Lady that. But if they try and vote in the House of Lords, or if they try and enter the House of Lords, they're not real Lords. I mean, to me, it's utterly and completely pathetic. It's utterly and completely pathetic. It's actually not completely irrelevant because only one today is a member of the House of Lords, a proper member. of the House of Lords. That is the boss, the president, Lord Reed. I think it's material. So, on to the second of my topics. How are we doing? Is it about 8 o'clock? No, we're okay. My students know I forget to finish class, okay? So be careful, keep an eye on the clock. The second, Brexit. Brexit. I told my students in England, I told my students, one of my students was sitting there, her job was to stop me talking about Brexit. That was her job. So I would be lecturing on something else completely, and I would suddenly start talking about Brexit. She'd do that. I'd say, sorry. So I'm allowed to talk about it now. It is a disaster, but and particularly risks. Anybody seen the movie Belfast? It risks violence in Northern Ireland. It's the most morally despicable act of recklessness that I have ever seen a democratically elected government do. Leave that aside. One of the main reasons for Brexit was a claim that Europe had taken the sovereignty of Britain. And in achieving Brexit, they contradicted the reason for Brexit, because you cannot simultaneously have lost your sovereignty to Europe while exercising your sovereignty to leave. I can understand when the southern states in the United States decided to leave, and Mr. Lincoln said, you can't, and they had a 5-year civil war over it. I can understand that the sovereignty of North Carolina had been inhibited by membership of the United States of America, but the United Kingdom went out, and nobody said they couldn't. It was a fundamental lie at the core of the Brexit story. There are many other sub-lies, but that was the main lie. And how they, unbelievably, how they explained it after the event was they said this in a government white paper. In a government white paper, they said, we acknowledge that sovereignty was not affected by the European Union. It felt like that. So they erected feelings to the level of policy. So feelings defeated truth and reason. It felt as though they had. It felt like that because bad faith, powerful commercial interests, and patriotic elites had chosen to say that. So for law, even for a new Supreme Court, parliamentary sovereignty is a challenge. Parliamentary sovereignty delivered Brexit. So an act of Parliament allowed a referendum. And then there was the question of how to leave. Now, you would expect a country so devoted to parliamentary sovereignty that it would wreck its economy in order to achieve it. You would expect the government would have asked Parliament to pass an Act of Parliament intending to notify the European Union of the exercise of its right of secession under Article 50. The referendum came first. And the next question was the notification of Article 50. Article 50 is in the Treaty of European Union, if it's called that, and it gives you a 2-year time frame to leave. The government chose to exercise the power without Parliament. This was challenged. So it came before the UK Supreme Court. And in the first Brexit case, the first Miller case, Gina Miller is somebody, look her up on Wikipedia, look her up. She's an amazing woman. She's part of the end of this story because she's a meddler. She's a do-gooder. She's a busybody. She launches cases. And she launched a case and she said, you cannot lawfully notify the European Union without an Act of Parliament. So how was the government doing it? Here's the point. Here's the legal point. There are three sources of law in UK. There's common law, which judges make. Not interested in that for now. There's acts of parliament, which set out laws. Not interested in that for now, which courts have to obey. But then there's something called the prerogative. The prerogative. Prerogative. And it all dates back to history as well. When your guy turned up and took over England, William the Conqueror, everything was prerogative. And gradually, the common law takes some stuff, and Parliament takes some stuff, and gradually most of it's taken, but there's still little bits left, which are called the prerogative. And then the government says the prerogative is the royal prerogative. It's the royal prerogative, but we're going to tell the Queen what to do. So that's another little sub-story, but the executive run the Queen. The Queen, you know, she's 95. Give her a break. You know, she still does all her homework and everything, not like the Prime Minister, but she doesn't have much real power. So she's ordered about. The court said, we cannot review Acts of Parliament, but we can review the prerogative. And you cannot use the prerogative to dodge Parliament. So something very significant happened in Miller 1. There's Miller 2 coming up, which is that the United Kingdom Supreme Court became the big fan of parliamentary sovereignty against the executive. My colleague Martin doesn't like this whole thread of cases. I think they're fantastic. They're quite unusually modern for British law. And so they say, we protect parliamentary sovereignty. You need an act. The government didn't like that. They had to have an act. They did the act. And that gave a 2-year time frame for Brexit. Once the notification was in. Now, we will pass over the whole period of negotiation. It's an embarrassment to thoughtful English people. In Ireland, we're big fans of Mr. Barnier. I don't know why you're not letting him be president of France. We love him. We took him to the north of Ireland. We took him to rugby matches. We gave him some wine. And he ended up Ireland's biggest fan. And he was in charge of the negotiations, as you may know, from the European side. The British side was chaotic. And the government found itself unable to get any deal. This is under a woman, underestimated, poor woman called Theresa May, decent prime minister. And Johnson took over. And Mr. Johnson said, right, if you're not going to do a deal, we're going to have no deal because we are a truly great country and we can continue to trade with New Zealand. And that's a huge place with lots of butter and it'll be all fine. And who cares if you're right next to us because we love New Zealand. And besides, we used to run India. We can do it again. I'm going to send a ship to India. And so what he did was, well, Parliament won't agree with that. So Parliament will not allow us to slip out without agreement. And he got one of his mates, an idiotic figure called Jacob Rees-Mogg. When you've been teaching in England for a very long time, like me, in, among other institutions, Cambridge, you recognize these people. They have a beautiful accent. They're immensely cultured. They patronize you and they're thick. Sorry. I'm sorry if that's offensive. They went up to Balmoral. The Queen was there in Balmoral. And they said to her, prorogue Parliament. Prorogue Parliament. This is a trick. Charles I had tried it. Prorogue Parliament. What that means is, Parliament's meeting. Parliament's not going to let us fall out of the European Union with no deal. So we're going to just stop Parliament. We're going to stop it. And prorogue means halt it for a while. Halt it for a while. And the Queen, because she, since, you know, the 18th century, 17th century, does what her executive tell her. She's not that old. She's nearly that old, but her forefathers. She issued an order in council. Council is a little gang of advisors, also from medieval times, who are technically her advisors, called the Privy Council. And she issued a kind of document called an order in council, which forced Parliament to prorogue. So the Speaker is there. He's the top man. He's saying he's in a bit of trouble at the moment, Burko. He's retired now. We don't want to dissolve. This is a disgrace. We go reluctantly, but we've been ordered to. Gina Miller, watching the telly at home, says, I'm not having that. John Major, former prime minister, I'm not having that. And Joanna Cherry, an estimable Scottish MP, says, I'm not having that. So they go to court. And in a ruling, which I watched in a cafe in London with people gathered around me, law doesn't normally make this kind of impact in Britain. 11 judges, led by Brenda Hale, president, wearing a famous brooch, the spider brooch. Her biography is called Spider Woman. So, you know, she's a little vain. Who can blame her? Said the executive cannot do that. They cannot exercise their prerogative to flout Parliament. And then, incredibly, they issued an order nullifying the order in council. In other words, slightly technical point, they didn't issue just a declaration that was unlawful. They didn't trust that government would act. And they were right. 3 weeks ago, in the United Kingdom Supreme Court, the United Kingdom Supreme Court has had to say to the government, if we issue a declaration, you have to obey it. For absolutely hundreds of years, we have issued just declarations of unlawfulness because we've always assumed that the government would then not want to act unlawfully. And the government argued in the Supreme Court last month that declarations are just like, they're just nothing. Right. Nothing. I've got a big case coming up, huge case in April, where we are looking for a declaration because we just take for granted. If you get a declaration something's unlawful, the Secretary of State and the government will actually rectify it. But this government doesn't even think it might do that. So the Supreme Court, in this case, they actually issued an order quashing this. Now, in English terms, that is dragging the Queen out of her little palace and pulling her straight into politics. And of course, that was what the government of Boris Johnson had done. And they failed again. So Parliament had to be recalled. The no deal did not happen. And then the rest of it's not relevant to our legal story. Johnson, having brought down Theresa May, then fights a general election in the depth of winter. And the general election is, we have to get Brexit done. I'm a hero. Britain is great. Keep those foreigners out. And of course he won. Because as you know, if we open that door in democratic politics, you can do very nasty out of it. Which takes me finally to the rule of law. Well, I've already shown you ways in which the courts matter in the United Kingdom, even though we have parliamentary sovereignty. Point one, you cannot question an act of parliament. We don't have what you're used to, what the Germans have, what the Irish have. We don't have it. There's a tiny little sub-story. Who decides what an act of parliament is? And the answer to that little sub-story question is the courts do. But they just haven't changed it for hundreds of years. They thought they might in 2004, but they haven't done anything about it. So take it from me, proposition one, you cannot change an act of parliament. Rule by law. But secondly, the Miller cases, you can constrain the executive in its exercise of the prerogative. So insofar as there is prerogative remaining, the executive can't just do what it wants. Thirdly, insofar as the acts of parliament allow space for interpretation, courts can be quite strict. The most famous example of this is a set of cases. There used to be just one, you don't need to know the name, called Anisminic, where Parliament tries to stop the courts overseeing the exercise of powers under its acts. That is really hard to do. The courts will interpret as narrowly as possible to stop it. Lord Carmouth, he's just retired, he came pretty close to saying the words in the Act of Parliament do not mean what they say. And I'm not going to tell you what they do mean. I'm just going to say they don't mean that. Pretty heavy. Fourthly, if there's something which the courts care about, and the contemporary court cares about it, protest, they will interpret laws narrowly to allow protest. This is a surprise. I've written a lot of books about how dreadful the courts are and how little freedom there is. Well, the courts, the Supreme Court, in a case middle of last year, Ziegler, they said it's okay to acquit people if they engage in occupation, if they engage in direct action. These guys had sprawled themselves out on the road in front of an arms fair, protesting, stopping all the traffic, and the magistrate had acquitted, and they said fine. And just last week, people who were engaged in a protest on Greenham Common against the terrible killing of a woman, part of the sort of Lives Matter kind of campaign, the courts upheld that. So there are exceptions to the strength of Parliament and the executive. Courts can find space in the British system to achieve some level of values. And finally, there is the Human Rights Act. One of the things that Mr. Blair and Lord Irving, Derry Irving, did early on was they got Parliament to pass a law setting out human rights. You know, the European Convention on Human Rights, it's that. And it's in an act of Parliament. So it's not the judges making it up. It's not a constitutional convention. It's a statute which says, please, please check we're doing the right thing in human rights terms. And the rights are the ones set out in the European Convention. And it includes the cases in the European Court of Human Rights. And that has made a big difference, which is where I end, because I've written an article in the London Review of Books. I said it for my students, actually, where the courts are pulling back from the potential to improve the socioeconomic rights of people, which is available in the Human Rights Act, because they are scared of the government, in my opinion. They're scared of the government. The government is very hostile to the judiciary, especially since the Miller cases. Mr. Johnson bears grudges, and so they're feeling under pressure. And the court, the Supreme Court, with the one guy who's a real member of the House of Lords leading it, they have said, we don't want to know anything about international human rights, thank you. We don't want to know anything about the Children's Rights Convention, no. We don't want to know what Parliament debated, and we want to stop all these Gina Millers, all these busybodies coming in here. We want to get back to old school inter-parties litigation. So it's a bit of what you might call pushback. So there you are, United Kingdom Supreme Court, Brexit, and the rule of law. And it's about 45 minutes. Awesome. Okay, I'll stop. Thank you.